threw the tie in the coat check girl's face, and headed for my apartment. Hall ran out behind me, but couldn't catch up. I didn't speak to him for the next 3 weeks, and when he got married the first time, I was in Paris, myself. The snow stopped entirely. When my mother died, and thank you for that lovely letter, I have kept it in a chest, along with some other letters that matter to me. I thought there was no worse pain. There are people you always love, no matter what they have done to you, no matter what you have done to them. I think Miss Hickok is one of those people for you. I hope so. When you are the kind of man I am, you get to envy wives and husbands, the Franklins and the Eleanors. And now I get to envy the Hickoks as well. By the time you read this, I hope that scotch and this deep snow will have put an end to me. My dear Eleanor, I am so sorry about Franklin. He casts light everywhere. Please forgive me for my deceit and my weakness. Forgive me further, if you can, for attempting to interfere with your happiness. I want you to have happiness. Your cousin, Parker Fisk. The show is not the show. Saturday noon, April 28, 1945, 29 Washington Square West, New York, New York. You and my cousin spoke, Eleanor says, more than once.
She's like a dog with a bone. Here's where Franklin would make one of his lousy martinis and tell a joke, but it's too early to drink.
Parker Fisk and I met from time to time after that. We sent each other notes, and sometimes books. 3 years ago, we sent each other The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, and he sent me a postcard of Siamese twins as a thank you. Last year, he sent me an old map of South Dakota, with dragons and tumbleweeds he'd sketched around the edges. He signed the back, "Your pal, Tom Sawyer." The first time we met, in 1934, he'd sent a note to my office, saying that he'd be waiting for me in the coffee shop across the street from the Mayflower Hotel, my home away from house then. Maybe he knew I was sleeping in the White House. Lots of people did. Sometimes I got mail there. We had a performance of Miss Lorena Hickok, friend of the family, coming for breakfast or dinner, which sometimes required me to slip out and stroll back in, sometimes for laughs. I'd tie my scarf differently, or pin a brooch to my hat band. Voila. He stood up when I came into the coffee shop, and before I could order my coffee, he introduced himself.
"I do believe we've met before," he said. "Two Christmases ago, at the White House."
He lifted his hat. He put his hand on my elbow and said,
"Would you care to join me?"
He stretched his long legs until his shoes touched mine, and then he stretched a little farther, so I pulled my legs under me.
"Good of you to come."
"I admire your work in the State Department," I said.
"And yours here at home. You must be back from your sojourn among the good people of the Dust Bowl and places beyond. Just back."
He waved the waitress over, and she poured us both coffee.
"I understand the reports you're doing for the emergency relief are excellent. Even Republicans weep over them."
"Pie," he said, meaning, obviously, a great big creature like yourself eats pie every chance she can get.
"Oh, no," I said. "A cup of joe will be fine." "Ever the reporter. Well, in a matter of speaking, I understand that your special friendship made journalistic objectivity impossible. All of Washington understood your dilemma. You made an honorable choice."
I sipped my coffee. All summer I'd been running into Louis Howe, Franklin's consigliere, roaming the White House halls in nothing but his boxers and a towel over his shoulders like a small, nearly naked vampire. He'd see me near Eleanor's room at all hours and say, "Well, ain't that a scoop?"
"Well, honorable, that may be a little much. I mean, you are stupping the First Lady. She is a married woman. I choked on my coffee, and I took my time, wiping my saucer, patting my blouse, and waving off the waitress so I could think about Parker Fisk threatening me and speaking Yiddish. A special friend had taught me Yiddish for every occasion, stooping included. Mr. Fisk, we don't know each other very well. It was true. I wasn't sure where I was going with it, but it was true. I don't know you personally, he said. I am familiar with your ilk, and I'm more than acquainted with the great lady of whom we are speaking. I was a page at the President and First Lady's wedding. I am their cousin, and it pains me to think, I shudder to think, what the President would say if he were to hear about the filthy byways into which you have pulled his wife. He dropped his voice on the word wife. You can stop shuddering, I said. He knows.
He does not.
Well, I say he does, and I say he won't appreciate hearing what is either nasty gossip or an unpleasant fact, or maybe not even that, coming from you. I know your ilk too, buddy. What's your point? That Franklin doesn't know, and if he did, there'd be hell to pay? Divorce? Not gonna happen. Disgrace? Not just my disgrace, pal. You know how men feel about having their wives stolen. And by a broad like me? I mean, it certainly wouldn't be fair if Franklin killed the messenger. But I can see it, can't you? He shook his head. Let me take a different approach. Your relationship with the First Lady is a thing of beauty. I don't wish you any harm, not at all. I thought we might have a mutual interest. I thought we might share information. I might tell you things, you might tell me things. What kind of things? I said. So many people come and go in the White House. There might be some visitors that would be of interest to some of my own friends. And my own friends, let's not say one person's name here. This one very powerful friend has no wish to look closely at you and your special relationship. You are a patriotic American. The First Lady is, of course, a great American. There might be some people who come calling upon her, who even wish to exploit her, and you might, from time to time, as a friend to our powerful friend, pass on names of people whose presence is notable, interesting. Just that. Just that. There was a part of me that thought, this is not the worst deal. Comfort the afflicted. Me. And afflict the comfortable, as Mr. Dooley used to say. Furthermore, when I was a reporter, I blackmailed people 100 times to get them to give me what I needed. Oh, Mrs. Jones, we're printing Mr. Jones' side of the story tomorrow. Don't you want a chance to tell yours? Gosh, I know I would. Parker Fisk said we would protect Eleanor and the rest of the country. I did love Eleanor, and I did love my country. I made myself stand up, like a person with integrity. Thanks for the coffee, I said. He left, and I slid my coffee over the bill for the tired waitress. She came by. Not you, fella? Not on a bet, I said. She took me in. Didn't think so. I went to the ladies' room and threw up. What Parker should have said was, I'll tell Franklin that I know for a fact that everybody's talking and that the president is facing an organized campaign of moral disgust. No divorce and no disgrace for the Roosevelts. Just Lorena Hickok out on her fat ass, and not another day or night or telephone call with the lady in question. That was always my fear. Not that Franklin would find out, but that someone else would persuade him that I'd overstayed my public welcome. That too many people, real people, Democrats who lived in small towns in Midwestern cities, seemed to know lesbian love when they saw it, and they were seeing it now. If that's what Parker Fisk was threatening me with, and all he wanted was some gossip in return, I'd been a fool not to listen. I sat in the stall until the waitress knocked. That night, Eleanor and I hardly saw each other. There were 16 of us for dinner.
Eleanor lifted a hand from across the room and I lifted mine back. The chances were pretty good that when the photo came out, in the Post or the Telegraph, I'd be cropped out of it. Heaven is what I cannot reach. Saturday night, April 28, 1945, 29 Washington Square West, New York, New York. Tonight, Eleanor and I are dumb happy animal selves. We do our stretches, my hips, her back, and take our antacids and we push and pull the pillows in a comic performance of old ladies getting ready for bed. Whoever gets into bed first sets the mood. But what we do hasn't changed much from 10 years ago. My hand's in her hair, and her left hand is on my left hand. There is a great warm border between us, and when things are the way they should be, she pulls my leg closer in behind her, and I smooth her hair back from her forehead. We sigh. We give each other little kisses in odd places, the elbow, the shoulder, the chin, years apart and other loves, and still, I feel like my heart has at last, and only now, returned to my body. She rolled over onto me last night in her sleep and said, "I miss you, my dear." I said, "I'm right here." And she said, insistently, "I miss you," and put her chin on my shoulder. Right now, I love Eleanor more and more easily at night than I do during the day. Sometimes, I love her more when I don't even see her. During the day, we are who we are, and that's too bad. The subject of Franklin, the person, seems to be off the table. To keep the peace, I act as if Franklin and I were great pals, and had he lived, we all would have come to a comfortable understanding. The war would end, and he'd retire to Top Cottage, Blowjob Cottage as I thought of it, his Hyde Park hideaway in the woods, away from mother and wife, alternating between glamorous babes and the devoted handmaidens, and Eleanor and I would get Val Kill, cozying up on the porch in matching cardigans with a pile of books to be read and thick notebooks for the books we'd write. We'd wave to Franklin when we saw him up the hill. When the kids came to visit, I'd step back. I'd have lunch in town and sleep in my bedroom, which I decorated in 36, making it look like the cell of a nun with a passion for the Dodgers and the New York Times. I kept an antique ivory brush and comb set on the dresser. When Eleanor saw it, she gasped. "That was my aunt's," she said. "It was in the attic," I said. "I thought it made a nice statement. I've even brushed my hair with it. I put two shirts in a drawer and hung two old dresses in the closet for show." I never stopped envisioning every piece of that life to come. The two cottages, our dogs, the way, over time, the kids would come to see how happy I made their mother and what good care I took of her. We would keep the best of our friends. Our love would create its own world and alter the real one, just a little. I could see the stand of birch trees at the edge of the stream near Val Kill, a few yellow leaves falling in. I could see our breakfast, the scrambled eggs still steaming, the newspapers folded. I could hear the creak of the rocking chairs on the porch. It is not true that if you can imagine it, you can have it. Eleanor hasn't eaten all day. I offer her a sandwich, scotch or sherry, crackers or her favorite muesli, and she keeps shaking her head. "When the children were small," she says, "she barely ate for 5 years because of everything." "Everything," she says, "five children and the baby died and then Lucy Mercer. And I was being such a fine, fair person and I thought, I will live with him and just not love him. And then he got polio and I heard the door slam. It was so terrifying," she says, "that she couldn't swallow." "You'll never guess who tracked me down," I say. Eleanor rolls over.
"Which girlfriend?"
she says flatly. Eleanor's understanding of our relationship was that our remarkable kinship, our communing spirits, made it possible for us to engage in physical intimacy, the likes of which she'd never known. Sorry, Franklin, but you learned absolutely nothing at Harvard, and not much from Lucy Mercer, who I imagine was the "you're my hero" kind of sex partner. I'll just say that after the polio, Franklin's own people spread the word that the man was paralyzed from the waist down. It can now be officially held blameless with the ladies, no matter how it looked. There's a certain lack of imagination among Roosevelt enemies, and also among the Roosevelts themselves. For Eleanor, lovemaking had everything to do with commingling of souls. She felt this way about all happy couples, that joyful sex had come their way because of their love, and when the sex faded away, their love would burn even brighter, because the source of fuel was now high, not low. I don't care why the light burns. I think that even if you're both old ladies riding side by side on the Second Avenue subway, with one of you going home to three grandchildren and a doddering husband, you can lock eyes and remember when you weren't. You remember that very pleasurable and surprising thing that was done to you by the wrinkly old bag of bones next to you. And you breathe in memory the weight, and the mortality and the sensible shoes are just costume, falling away, and your real selves rise up, briefly dancing rosy and naked in the middle of the subway car. My sister Ruby, I say. She saw my name in the papers, next to yours. First friend, I say, and I poke her in the side. She brushes my foot away and sits up, as if I have finally said something worth listening to.
I would love to meet your sister.
You will, I say, and I lure her into planning how to help Ruby, and then the rest of the world into considering that there's more to life than the widow of the great man. There's a whole third act, I say. Schools and governments and whole continents, all longing for her. The story is not over, I say. No matter how many times she says that it is. And we can start with making a nice luncheon with Ruby Hickok Claff, who wasn't as sweet as she was in South Dakota 30 years ago, but wasn't as soft either. Ruby did her research and came to see me at my little house on Long Island. She knocked on my door, and I didn't know her, and she threw her arms around me. By the time we sat down for coffee, I could see she was disappointed that I didn't live a more glamorous life, and she was more than disappointed to find out that I didn't even own the house. Everything I owned was my pots and pans, my clothes, my typewriter, two fresh ribbons, and three reams of paper, my car, and my dog. I cooked a couple of meals for her, and she slept on the couch. We got ready for bed. She told me how things had been for her in Wisconsin, with our mother's sister. Not really so bad, but I could have used you, she said. You looked out for me. She asked for a loan, which I expected, and I gave her $25, which was no small thing for me. She told me her husband was out of work, and that she was thinking of starting her own cookie baking business, if I'd stake her to it. Eleanor loves hard luck stories, and we can start with Ruby. Part 4. The Inundation of the Spring. Sunday noon, April 29, 1945, 29 Washington Square West, New York, New York. Eleanor had asked me not to come to the funeral.
It was a beautiful day, she says over her sherry. I cannot tell you how beautiful it was, very sunny and bright. I don't think there was a cloud in the sky. Dearest, the lilacs, white lilacs. Can you imagine they were out already, so early? You should have seen those horses, all decked out, pulling him up the hill from the train.
She wiped her eyes. I wiped mine.
There were fighter planes overhead, in formation. I don't know who thought that was the right touch. Maybe it was. They did the 21-gun salute. Fowler barked.
21 times? I say to make her laugh.
I think so. I didn't notice much besides the lilacs.
She slides down in the bed, back to the pillows, and curves around my hip. I look down at her and stroke her arm.
Her skin has always been finer and softer than other people's. Other women's. It's like old silk now, and the lines, the tiny diamonds traced on her skin, take nothing from the fineness. I should have had you come.
It's all right, I say. You couldn't do everything, not even you. You had all those people to organize and comfort and your own grief. You didn't need to worry about me, on top of everything else.
Are you quoting me?
Pretty much, I say. I took it as a compliment, which is what I said. When people asked, I told them that Eleanor didn't want her closest friends there. This funeral is for the whole world, I told them. She's going to do what must be done, and she's going to do it beautifully. It's not really a private occasion, I said.
I couldn't ask for you to be just one friend among many friends, one more face in the crowd while the whole world wept over Franklin and the reception. I wouldn't have had 5 minutes to hold your hand, for you to hold mine.
You could have asked, I say.
It was sunny on Long Island, too, the day of his funeral. The lilacs were out there, too. I took Mr. Coate for a walk in the woods in the morning, and even deep in the woods, in the thick, shifting light playing on the dead leaves and pine needles, the bright green shoots and narrow tines of forsythia, the spreading damask moss and fat red buds, were all breaking out and up, subtle as a cartoon. I came back and showered. I dried myself off without looking, and I patted myself all over with scented talc on a white feathered powder puff, the size of a frying pan. Eleanor had gotten me both last Christmas.
War be damned, she said. In 13 years, we'd only missed one private Christmas. And right then, that seemed promising.
I pinned up my hair and put on a clean shirt, my last remaining pair of the French silk panties, and gardening blue jeans. I sat at the kitchen table, watching the sky, wiggling my toes, trying to get more feeling in my feet. I ate oatmeal with almonds for breakfast, just so I could tell Eleanor I did. I looked at the bacon in my refrigerator and said, "Not today, heart attack." I made coffee the way I liked it and tossed Mr. Coate a biscuit. I leaned against the counter, watching the clouds. I had been lonely in my life, but never when drinking strong coffee, wearing my fleecy slippers, and standing in my own kitchen. By the time we saw each other, I'd have my diabetes back under control, and we could stop talking about it. I did my ankle, knee, and hip circles. I did my shoulder stretches and listened to Nisan Dorma. I sang Nisan Dorma, which surprised the dog. If you can be worried, hopeful, truly sad, and enjoying the weather, I was. Mastic was beautiful to me, all year long, but in late spring it was lush and tenderly green in every corner. My little house, peeling white paint and a kitchen out of Dickens, was my first real home since I left South Dakota. The fact that I rented didn't change my feelings. Renting made it better. Some people like to travel light and like to rent, and I am those people. To have a little white house on someone else's pretty property, to enjoy someone else's boat or beach or great front porch and not have to fix any of it is a particular kind of pleasure for me. Franklin and Eleanor were terrific owners of things. They were stewards of properties and collections and furniture that had been around for 200 years. They had silver. They didn't buy it, was what people like that said. I had 6 forks and 6 knives, and I always had 8 dinner plates in case I went crazy and threw a couple. The day Franklin died, I walked to the beach without the dog and broke all I had. He was the greatest president of my lifetime, and he was a son of a bitch every day. His charm and cheer blinded you, made you deaf to your own thoughts, until all you could do was nod and smile while the frost came down, killing you where you stood. He broke hearts and ambitions across his knee like bits of kindling, and then he dusted off his hands and said, "Who's for cocktails?" If Missy's strokes hadn't killed her, Franklin's cold heart would have. I planted pansies the morning of his funeral and worried.
I worried for the country. I worried for our soldiers. I worried for the poor and the Negroes. I worried for the Jews, who hadn't even been people to me when I was a girl. Franklin didn't do much for them, but he wanted them safe, even if most of America didn't give a damn. And I wasn't sure Harry Truman worried much about people who were not like Harry Truman. I was sorry for us all. Harry Truman was a decent man, but he was not going to be chugging brandy at 2 a.m. with Winston Churchill, belting out, marching through Georgia. Harry Truman would admirably do what he said he would do, in his stubborn, guileless way, and he would at least get us through the end of the war. There wouldn't be two courts in the White House anymore, two full sets of chutes and ladders for those in the know, and even if cocktails were served, Harry wasn't likely to dress up as Julius Caesar and sing, "I get a kick out of you," and Bess Truman wasn't going to make an appearance in a home movie as a Victorian maiden struggling, but not too hard, to get away from wicked pirates. Mousy Mary Margaret Truman wasn't going to make headlines. Franklin was a terrible husband, and an unnerving friend, and my rival, and my president. I had kissed him on his birthday one night, and he held on to my hand, pressing hard, and I was, for that minute, as in love with him as any of them. He'd left us, in a half hour, between lunch and dinner, when we'd let down our guard, and now we were all sick with grief. Those of us who knew him and needed him didn't want to stop grieving, for fear we'd step forward toward the future and entirely lose the trace, the smell, and the feel of him. It's all right with me. Sunday afternoon, April 29, 1945, 29 Washington Square West, New York, New York.
Dearest,
Eleanor takes another envelope from the gray canvas mailbag. It will be more love, more sympathy, and more requests for help in the form of cash and favors tucked into sympathy. I've gotten cash, and I've gotten favors, and I know better than to raise an eyebrow at even the boldest lie.
"Did I tell you?" she says. "I got a letter from Missy's sister."
"Handle a hand? That's nice," I say. Eleanor nods. I open the curtains and she shakes her head to make me close them. "Anna Lahand herself was not nice," I say. "You make me say these things. You make me say Anna Lahand wasn't nice. You won't say it, so I have to. I want to lie through my teeth. I'm sure Anna is still her envious, small-minded self and just a monument of resentment. The greatest moment in that woman's life must have been when that piece of shit Joe Kennedy put his hand on her knee at Missy's funeral." "I don't make you say these things." Eleanor turns on her bedside lamp. She looks at me over her glasses. "You choose to. And here I sit, about to remark on your basic decency and clear-eyed compassion."
"You're killing me," I say.
"We can. I hope we will. Go back and forth like this all day. Her propriety, my brass knuckles, her Hyde Parkiness, my South Dakota gloom. The Roosevelts cultivate chin up and make the best of it. None of them ever see that what they're making the best of is tons of money, a tenement's worth of servants, and such a grand old name that it doesn't matter that 200 years ago they were no better than the Hickoks of South Dakota, which is a damn low bar. Rich people." Stacks of condolence notes, to read or not to read, are in every room, spilling over the coffee table, snaking down to the floor, up to and under the couch. The first night, we put hundreds of the ordinary people ones right into the blue mail sack for the secretaries Tully recruited. Eleanor loves the ones written in pencil, the ones where people have fashioned their own envelopes from another piece of paper and a little glue. And if you don't have glue, you line up two corners, tear a little tab into the middle, and fold it back. I wrote letters that way myself 20 years ago, freezing my ass off in the Battle Creek post office, scrounging around for 2-cent stamps, so I didn't love them so much. The letters from the most famous people,
have already come. Churchill wrote, and Eleanor said, I know he meant it. Stalin's letter was sentimental and terrifying. The State Department sent Eleanor the front page of Pravda, trimmed in black. Admiral Kentaro Suzuki broadcast his mysterious condolences from Japan. He offered his profound sympathy. He praised FDR's leadership in bringing our country to an advantageous position in the war. It was such an un-American thing to do, to express genuine admiration for the man responsible for firebombing your civilians. We almost took it as propaganda. Eleanor said, I think Japan and America will never understand each other. Every minor royal joined in. Clementine Churchill's note is so elegantly heartfelt and well-written. I don't even make a face when Eleanor reads it aloud to me, again, and says, as she does every time Clemmy's name comes up, what a lovely woman. So strong, so much more progressive than he is, that big baby. Clemmy has a good head on her shoulders, let me tell you. She's better than he deserves, she says. As people always say about you. I bury my face between her shoulder blades. She reaches back to press my head to the base of her neck. This is the happiness I want. Not the tidal wave of early romance, swamping all the boats, carrying us to some impossible shore. I'm not looking for wildness, half undressed beneath the gorgeous blizzard of cherry blossoms that covered us and our picnic in the furthest corner of a Maryland park. I don't need another bruising, blinding sunset at Gas Bay. Fiery orange streaking over the green lawns and red cliffs, dropping into the dark sea, and leaving us to feel our way along the path. Her hand in my waistband, making the case that there's nothing for us to do but buy the cabin we're sleeping in and never go back. She caught my hand in the dark and said, We will live someplace just like this. I hold on to 100 secret candlelight dinners, a towel spread out on the hotel bed, plates on the nightstands, and 2 decanters on the floor, sherry and scotch. 200 secret lunches, working on her speeches with the windows open and the birds singing. Whole secret weekends beginning at 9 o'clock on a Friday night and ending before noon on Sunday. Every Friday night was Roman candles, and every Sunday morning, a slow, sad gathering up until we found ourselves, sitting over tea, just waiting for the hearse of real life to come to the door at noon. In that first year of craziness, whenever we were supposed to be working, there'd come a moment when everyone else had stepped out of the room. Our reports and folders slid to the floor. Eleanor put her hand firmly on the doorknob and locked it and untied the bow at her neck. Could we? She'd say. I remember every time we made love. I remember the light on her body, on dozens of beds. I remember all the blankets because I remember her hair spread out on them, caught in the weave and the smell of mothballs at Campobello, and the smell of the cucumber skin cream we both used one winter. I remember the satin ticking on the wool blanket at my place on Long Island, and her arms overhead, her fingers tucked under the stitching, gripping the wool. That's what I did at night, these last 8 years of being demoted to first friend. I remembered. I was still better off than poor dead Louis Howe, who had loved Franklin with his whole faltering manipulative heart. I was no worse off than Tommy Thompson, my pal, the other priestess at the shrine of Eleanor. Tommy's beau, Henry, was as undemanding as a potted plant. I used to refer to him as Tommy's beard. But that wasn't fair, because what was being hidden wasn't sex of any kind, but a devotion that makes sex look like a short swim in a shallow pool. The month of our final breakup was one long Alphonse Gaston routine. No one could go first, so we didn't go at all. Eleanor pretended that what she wanted, more than anything, was my happiness. If I complained about how little I saw her, or our long evenings with Earl Miller, her old bodyguard, and whichever wife he was married to, or my blood sugar,
or that the reporters dogged our every dinner out, was all evidence of my unhappiness. Unhappy was not the kind of girlfriend Eleanor wanted. I could stop bitching about how little time we had and stop complaining about the gossip, or I could stop being her dearest in all the world. And I pretended that all I wanted was her happiness. And if she was worried about me or my behavior, she was fretting about my gallivanting or nagging me about my diet or complaining that I hadn't come by in the 15 minutes she'd allotted to me, well, then, she wasn't happy either, was she? With all the goodwill and dissembling in the world, we almost dumped each other a dozen times. Still, we couldn't part. We stated the facts over multiple breakfasts. We made observations. We summed things up neatly, which was just like lying, and we both said that we would never stop loving each other, which was, unfortunately, absolutely true. We were determined to be the people we wanted to be, and not the blind, desperate people we were. Every few days, I said we needed to talk, and every few days, she said the same thing to me. One morning, Eleanor said brightly, "Franklin said you haven't been around much. He said he's missed seeing you." I said, "We really do need to talk. Get your hat. We can take my car." I drove to Rock Creek Cemetery so we could sit under her favorite statue. We got out, and Eleanor looked up at the big woman, grieving and almost peaceful. She smiled a little. "Oh, dear," she said. I said, "I love you. You love me. In another life, we would have the cottage or the school or the townhouse or whatever it is. But not in this life. Not in this life, Eleanor. And I'm not going to be the White House pet." I called her Eleanor to show I wanted to fight.
"What a thing to say. You're not a pet. You're part of our family."
I stood up. She shrank a little. "We could try. You could be patient. And when he's no longer president..." "When he's no longer president, which will be the worst loss of his life, as bad as polio, you're going to leave him? I don't think so." She put her hands on the base of the statue.
"I don't care what people say about us," she said. "And Franklin doesn't listen to gossip."
"Franklin has the greatest ear for gossip of any man I've ever known. He's heard plenty."
"Well," she said, "he has never raised any objection."
It was my turn to study the granite folds. Maybe it was all vanity. Maybe it was only that I didn't want to be first friend, barking but harmless and truly housebroken. I didn't think there was any decent way to say that since I couldn't destroy her marriage. I had to retire from the field. Franklin had won, as he and I and Eleanor had fully expected, and I wasn't even entirely sorry. The country needed him, and he needed her. "I appreciate that," I said. "Dearest, I don't think I can be what you'd like me to be. I will always want..." She didn't come to me. She sat on the bench and waited for me to finish. "I will always want to be your lover, your mistress, to have you be my mistress. However you put it, I don't actually want to be your dear friend. I want to have fights. I want to get jealous. Just a little. I want you to get jealous. I want to follow you into your room." She stood up and put her hands out.
"I wish you could love me a little less in that way," she said. "Not less. I don't mean less."
"Yes, you do," I said. I jangled the car keys. "You know that Dickinson poem? So we must meet apart, you there, I here, with just the door ajar.
You know, Emily Dickinson had no husband, no children. She did not have to do what I have to do."
"You're right," I said. "You are right about all of this." We drove to the White House in silence. I would move out and back to New York. I would still come and go to the White House. She would write to me often, and I would write a little less often. I'd counsel her about the kids, who mystified her,
and she'd send me a winter coat for Christmas. She would say, "Nothing has really changed." By 1939, I was part of the White House menagerie once more. My finances weren't in great shape, and Eleanor knew it. It so happened there was an empty room in the White House, as there usually was. It so happened that the room was not so close to Eleanor's as 6 years before, but it wasn't so far away either. And of course, Eleanor offered it to me. And of course, I accepted. I was included at meals, because it would be odd and revealing not to include me. Housekeeping tidied up my room. I wasn't asked about my needs or preferences or why the hell I was there, because no one wanted to hear about why my presence was desired, and despite everyone's relief that I was no longer first friend, it was too bad that I wasn't entirely gone, and it was upsetting to people that when I came into the room, Eleanor Roosevelt stopped what she was doing, as if there'd been a shift in gravity. She'd clear her throat and carry on, never looking anywhere near me. I lived in the White House and wrote for money. I hustled hard doing PR for the New York World's Fair, all 1,216 acres of it, trying to make Flushing, New York, a place people would come to by choice. I wrote press releases and brochures day and night for the World of Tomorrow. I wrote about the eyes of the fair, on the future, and the fair of the future. Familiarity with today is the best preparation for tomorrow. I wrote about the Westinghouse time capsule, not to be opened until 6939, in which we'd put a Mickey Mouse watch, 20 newsreels, a fountain pen, a woman's hat, Lily Deschay, a slide rule, a pack of Camels, seeds for all kinds of crops from carrots to cotton, some pages from Albert Einstein, and a book by Thomas Mann. I voted for Willa Cather, the great novelist, exemplar of chunky, no-nonsense Midwest womanhood. I interviewed the creators of Futurama and of Democracy. People closely involved with the fair tended to think of themselves as ancient, omniscient Egyptians, or as visionary beings, coming back from the future to share it with the average American. I quoted the chairman of the board of Westinghouse on opening day when he said, with no help from me, "May the time capsule sleep well. When it is awakened 5,000 years from now, may its contents be found a suitable gift to our far-off descendants." I ate lunch in the French Pavilion almost every day. I interviewed Jigs, the trained orangutan, and all of the almost topless ladies who modeled as Greek goddesses and Italian art. Franklin opened the fair with a televised speech about peace and our four freedoms, and the next day, television sets, the greatest thing since the radio, went on sale. Eleanor loved it. 44 million people came to the fair, and I was thrilled when it was over. I pretended every day to be Eleanor's friend. I pretended to feel fond and calm, concerned but apart. There wasn't any room for what I did feel, which was a sort of furious shame, run through with terrible strands of hope. This is not just the province of lesbians, I'm pretty sure. See, Eleanor, Missy, Lucy Mercer Rutherford, Anne Morrow Lindbergh, my mother. I pretended that other women, especially Marion, prettier, sweeter, less high hat, and less self-righteous, were just what I was looking for, which they should have been. When there was no one else in my bed, I imagined, like all lovesick girls, that the pillow was Eleanor's face, that my folded quilt was the length of her, that the dog at the foot of my bed would break the spell and reveal herself to be the woman I was crying over. Today, I'm putting my trust in the visible world, in our cups of coffee, our reading glasses, my insulin, her aspirin, our hairpins, our toast, hers dry, mine soaked with jam, and our pale naked feet, calloused and bony, pressing against each other. I do know better.
I know cups of coffee with our coral and red lipstick stains are no different, no more permanent than the pink and white cherry blossoms that shook down on us one beautiful afternoon. But I kid myself that if I skirt the mercurial and magic moments, the coffee cups and reading glasses will promise and deliver. I'm thinking of making a sandwich, I say. What do you hear from Joe Lash? This is not the smartest move on my part. Young Joe Lash is a thorn in my side. He is Eleanor's Princess Martha of Norway. And if I said that, I'd find myself standing in the hall, holding my coat. Eleanor sighs and smiles at me for the first time this weekend.
He wrote me a beautiful note. He's still in the Pacific. I do worry about Joe.
She worries about him all the time. She worries about him and reminds everyone about his brilliance and his dazzling principles. And if Joe Lash is in Guadalcanal because Franklin had him sent there, well, thank you, Franklin. Of course you worry, I say, which is a pretty good alternative to what I think. If Eleanor has to be infatuated with a man, I prefer Earl Miller, who had been her devoted, bull-necked, chivalrous bodyguard. I do like Earl, most of the time. He's married a couple of times, but he's always devoted to Eleanor, and nothing is beneath him. Joe Lash is devoted to Joe Lash. Earl Miller was Eleanor's knight. He flirted with her just enough and walked by her side, watching for varlets and puddles. If cloaks were in fashion, he would have laid his right down. Earl was some kind of masculine balm to Eleanor's hurt pride. You can see it in the photos. The man was always by her side, at her shoulder, not 2 inches between them. If he hadn't gotten her away from the kids, and onto the tennis court, and up the mountainside, hadn't kissed her hand, and waltzed her around at parties, I don't think I would have had a chance. Earl opened the door, and I walked in. I owe Earl. I don't think anyone owes Joe Lash anything, and Tommy Thompson hates him more than I do, which is good. Tommy's dislikes run deep, and if you aren't serving Eleanor, you're a worthless Republican, or possibly communist piece of trash in her eyes. So, compared to Tommy, I myself am Eleanor Roosevelt. Open, tolerant, and determined to give every idiot the benefit of the doubt.
I don't think you really appreciate Joe, Eleanor says.
Maybe not. I like Trude. She's very nice. She impresses me. And I can see how Joe might be the kind of son you wanted. I hope this is right. I certainly hope that late at night, alone in the mahogany bed, she hasn't been longing for his scrawny little arms around her. He's Jewish. He's a real intellectual. Maybe a commie. Definitely not a Roosevelt.
You're right, she says.
And she goes into the bedroom and comes out barefoot and without a robe, which are both remarkable events. And she pads back into the kitchen. Does Joe know about us? I ask. As we were. Eleanor puts our 2 sandwiches on a plate and boils water for tea. She pretends not to hear me, but because she is who she is, she can't stick with even this tiny lie of omission for 5 minutes.
It's not that kind of relationship. It's not about who I am, it's about who he is. He is the son I always wanted. He thinks I should be president. He lets me dote on him. He lets me make a fuss over him. And I have really come to love Trude.
When Joe went into the army, Eleanor made him a party at the Brevoort Hotel that was half coronation and half bar mitzvah. There was an 8-piece orchestra and Joe was radiant. He said he was honored and embarrassed, and all of us old hands were polite. Earl was an inch away from inviting him to arm wrestle.
With Joe, there are no terrible stories of what I failed to do when he was 6. or how I let him down when he was learning to drive, or how I've kept him from fulfilling his destiny.
I could say that Joe Lash seems to have a very firm grip on his destiny. But I want our day to be wonderful.
And I want my tea.
Joe Lash is very, very lucky to have you, I say. Her boys aren't bad, but I wouldn't want sons like them either. The Kennedy boys are more likely to succeed because Joe Kennedy is a toad, a bully, and a thief, and they'll be living down their old man all their lives. I don't say this. I carry everything to the table. Eleanor kisses me on the mouth.
Thank you, she says. And thank you for keeping your mouth shut.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm learning. And frankly, Joe Lash does not know the real you. I say, looking for the right tone. I do. Lazy. Capricious. Republican.
The real me, she says. Ooh la la. I believe Time magazine called me gracious, energetic, long-legged. I'm delightful. Time magazine said so. And long-legged.
She leans back in her chair, putting her long, blue-traced legs up in the air and flexing her feet. I hear the bones snap and pop. I put my thick legs up and flex my feet, too. We have two hammer toes, one bunion, and a little bit of gout between us. We do the ankle circles her doctor recommended, clockwise, counterclockwise. Symphony and arthritis, I say. She pokes me with her big toe and I stroke her smooth calf with my instep. We watch our feet and veined legs as if they were the best show since the Follies. I love this, I say. We haven't done this in so long. Eleanor props herself up on the cushions and strokes my arm. The little ring I gave her 10 years ago catches the light.
I haven't taken it off for weeks, she says.
The little sapphire ring was a fixture in the beautiful love letters Eleanor wrote me.
I say to myself, she must love me, or I wouldn't be wearing it.
I'd see the ring on her hand in newspaper photos when we were apart, and the sight of it was like being kissed on the mouth. Later, after we declared that we were friends and nothing more, we wrote cool and friendly letters in which she advised me on my diabetes and I asked after Franklin's health. Neither of us could bear to say,
how can this be the awful gray place in which we now live?
Then she went up to me. I'd written with the sad news that Teenie Schumann Heinck had died and I had mentioned going to the opera with a new friend as a way of celebrating Teenie's life. Eleanor wrote back a long, solicitous condolence note, offering to give my little sapphire ring back to me for safekeeping. Not, oh darling, what a loss for you, that magnificent woman who gave you such an exquisite education. Eleanor wrote 2 pages about the safety and security of the ring. Should she keep it in a vault? Perhaps she should have it delivered to me, where I could keep it safe in my pantry, my sugar bowl, the back of the icebox. I had so many people, such a large circle of friends, in and out of my shack. Where would it be safe? You never lock your doors on Long Island, and anyone, just anyone, could push the glass right through those sagging window frames with a strong arm, she wrote. I wrote back, wishing the ink was dripping acid, that the only value the ring had for me was on her hand. If it wasn't going to be there, she could give it to the suffering poor, whom I knew she liked so much, especially in the aggregate. She didn't answer that one, and she didn't send the ring back. I saw, as soon as she'd come in last night, that it was on her hand. And so much less grand than I thought it was when I was 24. I thought then that it was a serious piece of jewelry, the kind of thing Gable would give Lombard. And now I knew better. Eleanor rubbed it against her slip to brighten it, and shrugged, as if it was too hard or too sad or too late to say anything more about it. Ernestine Schumann Heinck was 55 years old when I met her. Silver hair in a bun, a collar of broderie anglaise, on top of ivory-watered silk, edged around with sharp points of lace, buttoned with gold and ivory roses, topped off with a poof of silver hair under a huge white cartwheel hat, as iconic in its way as the Eiffel Tower. She put out her soft hands, pink-tipped, and ivory under the white crocheted glove, and slid them forward beneath her coat's flounced sleeve to clasp my hands. I didn't understand, and she let me make a hodgepodge American butch half-bow, half-curtsy. I'd run through a Milwaukee rainstorm and managed to keep my wet felt hat on my head. I didn't acknowledge the water pooling under my cracked shoes. There wasn't a part of her that wasn't powdered or lacquered, corseted, draped, and ruched. I know now what it takes for a stout middle-aged woman to look good and keep looking good, and I feel for her. I couldn't take my admiring eyes off her. Eleanor would have found her ridiculous and vulgar, but if you want to celebrate quiet good taste, don't invite poor people. I'd had enough dirt-colored cloth, plain lines, and ugly things whose function was obvious to last me a lifetime. Eleanor used to show me pieces of rustic furniture from Valkill or Arthurdale, the way you'd show a Frenchman a pastry, I guess, as if just his pedigree made him a good judge of the thing. I hated every just plain folks piece of it, and when Franklin said he'd pay good money to see even one comfortable armchair come out of either place, I agreed. I suggested William Morris fabric, because it was the most expensive I'd ever heard of, and I suggested it'd be nice to have table legs you wouldn't split a shin on. Ernestine Schumann Heinck was very slightly past her prime. If she'd been at the tip-top, I don't think she'd have bothered with a small potatoes interview for the Milwaukee Sentinel. She was still commanding standing room only at the opera houses. She was still compared to Maria Malibran and Geraldine Farrar. She was a great contralto, and she'd sung with Caruso, but she knew, the way every pro does, that she was on the far side of the mountaintop now, even if her fans hadn't found out. She'd perch gracefully, working hard for another 10 years. She sang for the American war effort during the First War, and she sang for Jewish war relief. My mother was Jewish, she said. She gave me tenderness. She sang for 27,000 people in Balboa Park. She did lose her fortune in the crash, and I read that one of her sons died, and she was reduced to evenings of Danny Boy and Silent Night and chilling baby food. But from what I heard, she died a diva, surrounded by unpaid dressers, buckets of roses, and silk sheets. I was young. I was late. I was soaking wet. Her maid hung my dubious raincoat in a corner. I babbled about Geraldine Farrar's spoiled dog to show that I was firmly in Madame Schumann Heinck's camp, and I told her I wanted to get a German Shepherd. I told her that I pictured a Christmas card of me and the dog in matching raincoats and in December in matching Santa hats, and she laughed. "You are charming," she said. "Rough outside, sweet inside. Franz Brötchen." The maid gave me a look and poured us glasses of Riesling. A waiter from the hotel brought us a proper German dinner, crisp duck and peeled potatoes sprinkled with parsley, and hot, sharp purple cabbage with caraway seeds, and a whipped cream tort. The only one of those things I'd eaten before was potatoes. It was a long, languorous dinner. "Call me Teeny. Everyone does." I'd had fun dinners on boarding house floors with cheap bottles of wine and roasted bratwurst and girls who thought I was the next William Allen White, or maybe the next Steinbeck, or maybe, at least, the next Edna Ferber. But I'd never sat on a velvet divan with a famous and perfumed woman kissing my neck, pressing her pearls against my overheated skin, saying, "I'm going to loosen my stays, Messebert. You pour us another glass."
At midnight, I struggled to my feet.
Must you? She said.
I'm the society editor. I have to be at work early.